Robert Henry, professional communicator, shopping at a discount store for binoculars. Had a few questions about binoculars, and he's the only guy in the store, only customer in the store. There was a store clerk that was stocking some shelves, and there was a store clerk there at the counter. He happens to ask the person who was stocking the shelves. That person didn't know anything. I don't know, you have to ask her. So he walks over to the counter, and that particular clerk was on a personal phone call. You ever had that happen? They're on the first. And she's talking away, looks at him, and just looks away. And and he just stands there patiently for a few moments, and finally she lowers the phone down. Yeah? He says, yeah, I just got a few questions. And she says, you need to take a number. He's like, what? There's nobody else here in the store. Store policy, you have to take a number. So he goes back and picks up number 37. She gets back on the phone, talks for a few more minutes. Finally, she gets off the phone, and she goes over and pulls a number. She goes, all right, number 30. Waits for a few more minutes. Number 31. You can imagine what's going through this guy's mind. Robert, he's like, oh, my goodness, this is going to take forever. Eventually, she gets to number 37. He just about had it, though. He gets up to the counter, and she goes, what can I do for you? I mean, that's about her attitude. And he says, nothing. Lays down some binoculars and walks out the door. He said, I just about had it. This clerk had lost perspective of what she was there for. She had lost the objective. The objective is to provide customer service. In our culture, we get to customer no service. Anybody listen to Clark Howard? He talks about that all the time. Customer no service. That's what you get in our society. You know, but without people, there would be no purpose for that store. And if there's no purpose for the store, she's out of a job. So she can just talk on a personal cell phone call all day if she wants, right? And that's how people, you know, they don't think about what are they in business for or what are they doing. I had a similar circumstance not too long ago. I was with Chip and Lee, and we were going to California, and we're down at the airport, and just some circumstances happened, and we were, I think, 32 seconds late from officially checking in. We were there, what, an hour and a half before the flight, but we were 32 seconds late, so they were going to bump us from our flight. I won't say what airline it is, but I'll never fly them again. It starts with a D and ends with an A, but I won't tell you what it is. But to talk with this guy, and if you would have seen all three of us, two guys are just kicking back, no big deal, you know, we just got all day. And I'm always the guy who says, you know, I'm not going to waste my time, you know. And we just got customer no service. And I'm thinking, I don't remember if I said it or not, but it was loud in my mind. Look, buddy, if all of us were treated like this, we won't be back at this particular airline anymore, and you'll be out of a job. You think it mattered to him? No, not at all. But without people, there wouldn't be a need for an airline. Yeah? No, but people forget that. They think they've got their procedures, and they've got their structures, and all of this. Have you forgotten what you're in business for? I think sometimes churches forget that too. Without people, would there be any need for church? Church is people. It's not buildings. It's not processes and procedures. It's people. And God saves people and puts them into the body. And he calls it a church. But sometimes we forget the need we have for each other and people. We get into the program, or we get into the structure, or we get into this particular mode of thinking, and we forget. We lose perspective, and we lose the objective. Now, what does that got to do with Philippians? As I look at this passage, and Paul is coming off of his sermon from chapter 2, verse 1 through 4, or 1 through 5, in chapter 2, the very first part here. Therefore, if there's any encouragement of Christ, if there's any consolation, love, if there's any fellowship in the Spirit, this is talking about the church. If there's any affection and compassion, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. This is the body coming together. You are here for each other, for the glory of God. And he goes on to say, as you live in this body, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. It's the demonstration of God's love through the church. Verse 4, do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interest of others. So, verse 5, have this attitude in yourselves, which is also in Christ Jesus. So Paul has this sermon in verse 1 through 4, and then he illustrates it. He wants you to have a picture. What does this look like? It's one thing to have lofty goals there, but can you put some flesh on it for me? So Paul gives the illustration of Christ, who is the most excellent of all examples of one who humbled himself, taking the form of a bondservant, a slave, even to the point of death for someone else. Now he's going to bring it back down to humanity a little more. He says, I use Christ, and people will look at that illustration of Christ, yeah, but he's Jesus. Anybody live like that? He gives a little illustration of himself there in verse 17 and 18. Then he's going to end up in verse 19 through the end of the chapter giving you two people to look at. Let me give you somebody who you are well familiar with, who take that message of verse 1 through 4 and illustrate it out. Now, he's using this as an opportunity to convey some news to them about how Timothy's doing, how Epaphroditus is doing. Those are the two men we'll look at. But in the context of the whole chapter, he's just illustrating out what all of us need to do. If you don't think you can live up to Christ's example, let's look at Timothy. Let's look at Epaphroditus. They are doing the very thing I'm asking you to do from verse 1 through 4. Don't forget your objective. People are important. You must work together. The Christian life is not a solo life. If you know anything about Paul, you know he never lived alone. He never traveled alone. We know much about Paul and little about his companions, but he always went with people. I think Paul's whole value of life was to live for the glory of God and the joy of other people. He knew he was going to experience joy in life, and he wanted to have others along with him to experience the same joy. You have that same perspective? I'm going through life. I'm accomplishing some things. I want to meet some goals. Do you take anybody along with you to experience the same joy? Let me just give you a couple of observations from this. Who is Timothy? Who is Epaphroditus? And what kind of illustration is Paul giving us here? Because I think these are illustrations that he's giving us that we may implement or copy, if you will. The example of Timothy. Timothy is more like a son to Paul than anything else. He loves him like a son. Timothy's name means honoring God, honored of God, worshiping God, valued of God. Great name. He's a native of Derbe or Lystra. We see that in Acts chapter 16 as Paul was coming across the country. He encounters Timothy and his mom and grandma, leads Timothy to the Lord. And after that, that's when Paul had the vision to come into Macedonia, to come to Philippi. And so Timothy was a young traveling companion early on by the witness of Paul coming to Christ and then joining him as a missionary. He's a child of a mixed marriage. He had a Greek father, a Gentile father, and a Jewish mother. Though he was not circumcised until he was a young adult, we know that his mother and his grandmother taught him the Old Testament scriptures of the Jewish faith. It led to Christ by Paul. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 17, Paul tells of Timothy, who is my beloved and faithful child in the Lord. And you see it here as well in verse 22 in Philippians. He's a child serving his father. They've got that intimate relationship that a father has with his child. He's raised him in the faith. He's connected with him. He wants to teach him all the things that a father wants to teach a son. Four things that you can see in this text as Paul characterizes Timothy. First word that you pick up on is kindred spirit. He's a kindred spirit. I love how he phrases it here. For I have no one else of kindred spirit. A kindred spirit. Isopsychos is the Greek word. It means same souled, same mind. In math, we'd say the triangles are congruent between the two. David and Jonathan, in the Old Testament, in 1 Samuel 18, it says the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. A couple of chapters later, it says Jonathan loved David as he loved his own life. I see this picture here when he uses the term kindred spirit. Anybody ever heard that term? You know, it's only used in the New Testament this one time. No other time is this Greek word used for kindred spirit. But it's this term that says, you know what, we're like models of each other. You know, like a son is like a father. You look at a son and you go, he looks just like his dad. Sometimes you go, well, he doesn't act like his dad. And for Timothy and Paul, if you think about their personality, they're nothing alike. Paul is bold. Paul is a trailblazer. Timothy, if you know anything about Timothy, he's more timid. But they think alike. They have the same passion and goal. They may get there a little differently in how they accomplish what they do. But you know what? When Paul says he's a kindred spirit, he's saying, you know what? He is the best representation of me that I could send to you. If I was going to send someone in my place, Paul is bound to these prison guards and he'd like to send somebody. He says, if I think of all the people in all of the world that I could send that would best represent me and my message, it would be Timothy. He's a kindred spirit. He's like one of those guys that you don't even have to say anything, but you can communicate. You ever had people like that? I hope that's like that in your marriage. That, you know, Jennifer and I are like that. Not on everything, because I don't always get it. But many times, I don't have to say anything, and I can just look at her, and she can look at me, and we've already communicated a couple of paragraphs there. We just know how each other thinks. We've been together long enough. And when you have that kind of intimate relationship, and men ought to have that with men, a few men, and women ought to have that with a few women, that you just have a kindred spirit. It's not, oh, I like her, or, you know, I get along with him. But it's that connection that you don't have the same personality, but you think alike. You understand each other. It's an intimacy that you don't get just with everybody. You get maybe once or twice in your whole life. Paul didn't say that about anybody else, and he encountered many. He said, with Timothy, he's my kindred spirit. He's same souled. He's just like me in passion. If I was going to duplicate myself, it would be Timothy, because he is just like my heart. I love that about that. Do you have anybody like that who is your kindred spirit? Anybody that your soul has been knit together like David and Jonathan? The likeness, the trust. You could lay your life down for that person. They'd lay their life down for you. Second characteristic you'll see is of genuine concern. Starting to see a little bit who Paul is through Timothy. In this kindred spirit, for I have no one else of kindred spirit who will genuinely be concerned for your welfare. He could send Timothy because Timothy had a heart for those people, just like Paul had a heart for them. He had genuine concern. Now, it's fascinating that Paul uses this term, concerned. It's the very same Greek word that's translated in Philippians 4:6, anxious. You know, in Philippians 4:6, it says, do not be anxious about anything, but in all things, through prayer and supplication. Same Greek word, anxious. But here, he uses it in a positive light. He uses it, he's genuinely concerned. He passionately worried about you. He really wants to connect with your pain, with your concerns. But it's in a positive effect. You have to do more study about what's the difference between negative anxiety and positive concern. It is good to be concerned for people. Maybe it boils down to, in your concern, do you still trust the Lord is going to care for it? Or are anxious because you still think that you have to control all the outcomes? Same word, but translated differently and implied differently. He was genuinely concerned. He knew these people. Remember, Timothy was saved under the ministry of Paul, and then his first missionary journey, his first mission trip as a young kid, was with Paul to Philippi. And Paul, in Acts chapter 16, as he goes to Lydia, and he transforms that demon-possessed girl, and he's sitting in prison, and the Philippian jailer is transformed, Timothy's there on the front row. He gets to be a part of all of that. Can you imagine, as your first missionary journey, getting to go and see all of that? It'd change your life. Well, it was changed his life. And he was genuinely concerned about the Philippian church. So it is true. As he says, he really does care about you. These aren't just flippant words. These aren't just words that Paul says about some of his helpers. No, Timothy had a heart. Probably prayed often, cried often for the Philippian church as they would hear report. Verse 22 says one other characteristic. It's proven worth. His proven worth. But you know of his proven worth. Why? How do they know? Because they've seen Timothy in action. The same word is used in Romans 5:4, but it's translated proven character. It's someone who doesn't just seek their own success. But Timothy, we know, proved he was in ministry for the glory of God and the joy of others. Willing to give up his whole life. He left his mom and grandma, if you recall. He came to Christ and he sought everything that Paul sought. He wanted to give it all. Proven worth, proven character is when you change your whole focus of life from me and you turn that M upside down. What does that look like, kids? You take an M, you put it upside down. It's a W, and with an E, it is we. Paul knew that he was in it for all people. Timothy took that same model as a kindred spirit and says, I'm not in this for myself. See, Timothy didn't ever seek out to make a name for himself. He just thought, if other people could be affected, if the Philippian church could be affected, if he could just run alongside Paul and help in any way that people could be saved. It's not about me, it's about we. That's a different perspective than some ministers I know. Because it's all about them. May God remove any minister from ministry if it's all about them. His proven worth was showing his character was about others. It was about the glory of God. The last thing you'll see is his servant's heart. In verse 22, you'll see the term that he served with me like a child serving his father. There's two phrases here, the serving with Paul and the serving of Paul. He was had a servant's heart. Humble service. Not trying to supersede anything Paul was doing, but just running alongside, can I be of help? It's a humbling position. But when you understand the context of this whole passage, and he says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves, you begin to understand how Timothy thought, how Timothy lived. We have a hard time with that in our society, though. Even in our own homes, we seek position and power, and we prefer to have the upper hand, to get the last word. Anybody guilty? I see it better. I know better. Could we be a Timothy and to take a second seat, be second chair, just to be of help and allow God to open up the doors and not trying to make things happen? We get into power plays with people. Ultimately, it doesn't matter what position we have or matter what kind of power, humanly speaking, we have. If we don't glorify God and we don't invest in the joy of other people, our life is really worthless. Do we have proven worth? A man of some wealthy means came into a restaurant, comes there quite often, but he comes in, he sits down, and they had a new waitress, and waitress comes over and serves him, and in a few moments, he starts barking at her, you know, complaining, I want some more butter for my toast. And she says, you can't have any more butter for your toast. Pretty bold move. And he says, I want to see the manager. And she says, fine. She goes over, gets the manager. The manager comes back and says, what do you want? He says, I want more butter for my toast. He says, I'm sorry. She said, you can't have any more butter for your toast, so I'm going to go with my employee. Okay. He walks away. This man is fuming. He looks at the waitress and says, do you know who I am? I'm the man who owns the big factory down the street, and I have thousands of employees. Do you know that about me? She says, no. But do you know who I am? He says, no. She says to him, well, I'm the woman who says whether you can have butter or not, and I say no. A little power play. Doesn't matter how high up you are or wherever you are, we do power plays sometimes. But do we have a servant's heart? Starting with that first story we talked about, do we understand what we are in business for? I think our government needs to be reminded of that sometimes. We wouldn't have a government if it wasn't for people. I don't care what side of the aisle you are on, Democrat, Republican, or somewhere in the middle, or you've just given up years ago. Do we have a servant's heart? That's Timothy. Timid Timothy, with the kindred spirit, a genuine concern, proven worth, and a servant's heart. But what about Epaphroditus? Who is this guy? Do you know much about this guy? Have you ever considered using his name to name one of your children? 12 letters. I just love it. I'm like, I haven't convinced my wife yet. Epaphroditus, he's not a son to Paul, but he is a brother. He uses the term here in verse 25. He's a brother. He also says he's a fellow worker and a fellow soldier, but he's more like a brother, akin to him. He's a brother in the faith, Epaphroditus. We know very little about him because this is the only place he's mentioned. This, and in chapter 4 of Philippians, mentions him because he's the one who brought the financial collection. Epaphroditus is the one who gets to carry it to Paul. His name means lovely, handsome, and charming. It's a great name. He's also, like Timothy, though, a leader who didn't choose to make a name for himself. As good as Epaphroditus was, and probably a significant leader in the Philippian church over time, he didn't choose to make a name for himself. He just chose to make Christ's name known. It's fascinating, the transition here. Paul was the Hebrew of Hebrews, and we see how he lives his life. Timothy was a mixed race from Jewish mother and Gentile father. Epaphroditus was all Greek, all Gentile, Gentile origin. But how does God use these three different people? He was a brother, a worker, and a soldier. Just using those phrases there, I think we can see some things in the text, and that's what we'll make our observations from. He's a brother. I'm going to call that he loves people. There is a kindred love, a kindred type spirit here. He's in love with people like you love your brother. You may not always get along with them, but nobody ever messes with your brother. You know, I can beat him up, but you can't. I love my brother. You know, I love my family. And that's how I see Epaphroditus. He loves people. He loved Paul. He loved his church. So in the text, looking down, it says here, in showing his love, in verse 26, it says, because he was longing for you. A yearning, a desire for you, the Philippian church. And also, he was distressed because of you. Because you had heard that he was sick. Now imagine this, and commentators disagreed on when did Epaphroditus get sick? We don't officially know, but we know this from the text. At some time he was healthy and he was in Philippi. They did an offering, a collection for Paul and his ministry. They gave it to Epaphroditus. Epaphroditus, the trusted one of the congregation, young and strong and bold, he was going to take it from Philippi all the way to Rome and give it to him. Between that point and the time he's with Paul, he gets sick. My assumption is, from reading the text and knowing that they had heard back in Philippi that Epaphroditus was sick, my assumption is he got sick along the way. Because probably as he's traveling, and that's a long journey, he meets up with somebody who's going the opposite direction, back towards Philippi. And so as he's sick, but he's pressing on, someone meets him and says, yeah, I'm not feeling so well, but I'm going to continue on because I've got this love offering we're going to give to Paul. And then that person hears it and goes back and tells him he's sick. Just makes sense to me. It makes more sense to me, too, because they didn't know he was sick to the point of death. That probably took place once he got to Rome. But Paul reports to them, he's sick, not just sick, he was sick to the point of death. They hadn't heard that yet. But now they're going to get a letter, and this is the beauty of it. Epaphroditus is the one who gets to come back and deliver the letter. And they're going to get to read it, and he's going to be standing there, and they're going to go, you were sick to the point of death? Yeah, but look at me now. God has healed me. I get to be the living, you know, testimony, the living letter from the Lord right here in front of you. But I was sick. Well, you see here that he loved people enough because he was concerned when he had heard that they knew that he was sick. Sick on the road, but he continued on and he served Paul. He was the trusted one that was sent with the money. The loves people and then tireless worker is the second thing. Because he pressed on, and he was going to get to Paul, he was going to accomplish his job. He was going to do what all he could to help the ministry progress. He was a tireless worker. And then down in verse 30, an observation, because he came close to death for the work of Christ, nothing would slow him down, even sickness. You ever had to do anything while you're sick? You had too much to do, you couldn't slow down long enough to be sick? I guess it just depends on how important the task is, whether you just lay down and do nothing or if you press on. And I see him, Epaphroditus, the man who doesn't make a name for himself. He's a tireless worker, and he knew, this is for the cause of Christ. I will press on, no matter what. I read one pastor said this. He says, the problem in our church is that we have too many spectators and not enough participants. Epaphroditus was not simply content to contribute to the offering. He wanted to be an offering. He offered it all, even to the point of death. Isn't that what Christ did? Christ wasn't content just to send an angel to kind of comfort you a little while. He came himself. He was the offering, even to the point of death. Third thing you can see about him is this: risk taker. He was a risk taker. You know, if he's the brother who loves people and he's a fellow worker who is a tireless worker, you see, Paul mentions that he is a fellow soldier in verse 25, and a soldier is in it to the death. The best soldiers are those who would give it all, not run at the heat of battle. In verse 30, it says he risks his life. A risk taker, the one who risks his life, is one to be exposed to danger, willing to risk it all, willing to put their life on the line for the sake of others. He was risking his life for the Philippian church and for Paul. For the joy of others, he was willing to lay it all down. The glory of God and the joy of others. That's the example we have in Epaphroditus. These are examples to be followed. Timothy, Epaphroditus. We know very little about them, but Paul uses them as illustrations. Following Christ's illustration of what it's like to live as a humble life. Let me give you the last three observations I have just as a big picture. There's on the back of your handout if you've got one of those. So I thought, okay, that's nice. We can look at them and say, yeah, they live that way. And could maybe if I had a kindred spirit, if I had an opportunity to risk my life for someone else, I would do that. I think in the big picture, this is what I'd give you. Three observations worthy of your application. What do you do tomorrow morning? Number one is this. Joy is in the humility. Because we're talking about joy throughout this whole book. He keeps talking about this joy. And here he's focused in chapter 2 about humility. Humbling yourself, serving others' needs. Joy is in the humility of investing your life in the lives of others. In verse 17 of chapter 2, and I didn't have it as a part of your handout, but Paul says he was poured out like a drink offering. If I had a big bowl, a basin here, and a pitcher, imagine this is Paul, and what does he do? He sees the lives of others, and he's poured out for the sake of the glory of God and the joy of others. He wants to pour his life into the lives of others. You see that? Why did Paul care a lick about Timothy and take him with him? What a risk that would be to take an unproven kid who just came to Christ, had probably more energy and less brains than he needed at the time. He probably thought he knew it all, but he didn't. But he was timid. But Paul takes Timothy on the journey. He takes Luke, the doctor. He takes Silas and so many others with him. Every time he goes, Paul's whole ministry is about pouring himself into other people, investing in others, because he knew the gospel would last a lot longer than his own life. Poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, he says in verse 17. And I rejoice, there's the joy, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. He developed sons, he developed brothers, he developed churches for the joy that they would have in the Lord. So my question is, thinking about these two men, and Paul specifically, as they poured their lives out for the others, they invested their life, who is it that you are investing your life in? Who is it that you're contributing to? Either on a grand scale or just a little scale. Who is it that when they are in your presence and then they walk away, they are better for the experience? Are you lifting people up? Are you giving them something? Now, I don't like to give unsolicited advice too often. I do. You hang around me long enough, you'll get my opinions. But when it's dealing with you and you ask, I'm going to give you something, and you have the privilege of taking it or leaving it, I might be way out in left field. You never know. But do you take the opportunity to help people along the way, to encourage them, to pour your life into them, to invest in them? Even before I knew what I was doing, most of the time I feel very inadequate. Anybody ever feel inadequate with trying to help people out? You want to help, but you have no idea what you're doing? Well, when I had my first baby, we had Nehemiah. Leading up to that time period, you know, I'm in a rural church in Missouri, all right, 100 people, 300 people in the town, 100 people of them came to my church. And we got this baby coming, and I'm a little nervous going, okay, we lived 100 miles from the hospital to go have this baby. And I thought, Jennifer, sure enough, she's going to have that on a Sunday, and we're going to have to drive down, and who's going to preach? We didn't have in a rural area just 100 pastors around you could call upon. And nobody within the church ever felt equipped. So who do you call on when you do it? I prepped a few deacons saying, you're going to preach for me. And you know what the deacons told me? No, we're not. We're not going to preach for you. It's like if I just said, Dwight, you're up next Sunday because I'm taking vacation. Dwight would tell me, well, let Chip continue to preach. All right? My most trusted chairman of the deacons at the time, I said, Ronnie, it was Ronnie Ward. You remember Ronnie Ward? Ronnie Ward has a heart of gold. But he was the most timid man. He was a farmer, didn't like to get up in front of people. I said, Ronnie, above all people, I think you've got the most wisdom. I think you have the most to be able to say. I want you to fill the pulpit. He said, I can't do it. I says, I know you can't, but you have to. And sure enough, we had our baby. I don't remember, it was like Friday or Saturday. And I called Ronnie. I said, you're up. And he did. I wasn't there. I can't imagine. You know what it was like? I think they said it was like 9 minutes long. And he did it. He did it. He shared what God gave him. You know what Ronnie's doing today? He's a preacher. Every Sunday at a church about 20 miles away from that church. Every Sunday. Well, you know what took place? And I joke about this, but I think this is true. Ronnie looked at me and he was like, well, gosh, if he can do it, probably I can too. You know? And when Ronnie did it, Chris in our congregation, a man named Chris says, I think I could do that. And he did it. And then another man named Bob did it. And another man named Bruce did it. And out of that little church, out of nobody who knew, had a clue about seminary or didn't know much about the Bible, but they loved Jesus, and one by one, four preachers came out of that ministry in 3 years. Amazing to me. And then there's another man who wasn't a part of our church, but he was somewhere else, and his pastor did the same thing to him, told him, I'm going to be out. I need you to fill the pulpit. And he couldn't do it. He did it. That man, now his name's Tim, and now he's preaching at the church that I was at. But these four men have gone on. Actually, one of them, Bruce, now is the director of missions over the whole 21 churches, associated churches there in that area. I'm like, it amazes me. It just amazes me that God, if you'll just give people opportunity and just press on them, that you could pour your life into them and see what God does. I didn't know what I was doing. But you know what? I knew it wasn't about me. It was about we. And now churches are being blessed just because I got out of the way and I said, you do it. Here's the second thing. It's one thing to say, well, I'm going to invest my life in others. Here's another step. Joy is in the humility of trusting your life to the lives of others. Not being in the driver's seat, but once in a while sit in the back seat and let someone else drive for you, care for you, take care of you. Paul trusted Timothy enough to send him as a replacement for himself and Epaphroditus in his place. He trusted these two men to serve him and his needs. He trusted them to care for and minister to him. He trusted his heart to them. In verse 27, it says, I mean, he didn't know Epaphroditus all that well, but when Epaphroditus comes with the money, he falls in love with this man because of his heart. And if Epaphroditus would have died, Paul would have been much sorrowful. Not just because a man died, but because this was a brother to him. You see this in verse 27. It would have broke his heart because he gave his heart over to Epaphroditus. He loved him. It's hard to take this position. Those of you who are more leader types, oh yeah, I'll invest in others. But how many of you will allow someone else to invest in you? Even when they're not as gifted as you or as wise as you, but you can still be ministered to by them. You know, at the end of Paul's life, his last book he wrote was 2 Timothy. And in chapter 4 of that book, he cries out to Timothy, he says, make every effort to come to me soon. I want to be with you. It was the kindred spirit. I've entrusted my life to you, Timothy. I love you like a son, and now I'm like the old father who needs his son to come care for him. That's a humbling position to say, I need others in my life, trusting my life to you to take care of me. You know, there are some people who say you shouldn't attend other people's funerals because they'll never come to yours. But God says you might as well love all people and trust them with your heart and life now. The third thing is this, just a big observation, I'm kind of just seeing the text, see if you see it with me, is joy is in the humility of trusting your life and the lives of others to the will of the Lord. You see Paul's language here, and just see the repetition here. In verse 19, he says, but I hope in the Lord Jesus. That's where his hope was. It wasn't in Timothy. It wasn't in Epaphroditus. His hope was in the Lord. Look at verse 24. He says, and I trust in the Lord. And then in verse 29, he says, receive him in the Lord. See, when Paul considered ministry and he considered his own life and he considered the life of these two young men that he was ministering with, his trust wasn't in himself or in others. He entrusted his life and their lives in the Lord. My hope is in the Lord. The Lord will accomplish his work. He who began a good work in us will carry it on to completion. I trust in him to take care of all things. Because he knew if his life had been sacrificed for the Lord, whatever the Lord wanted to do with Paul's life, whatever the Lord wanted to do with Timothy and Epaphroditus' life, whatever the Lord wanted to do with the Philippian church was up to the Lord, but he was going to give it all. I hope we haven't fallen into the trap that this other church did. There's a church that they joined together the congregation because they liked the people that were there and they had the truth. You know, that we've got the gospel truth that nobody else has. You know, we understand it more than those other liberal churches. We've got the truth. And then they threw, I don't know how people advertised, but they had a neon sign that said, Jesus only. Real proud and bold. Jesus only. And they gathered it together and it was all about Jesus and they preached Jesus and they loved Jesus and it was all about Jesus. But you know what this church didn't do? They never reached anybody else because they had the truth and everybody else was wrong, and so they just got together in a holy little huddle. Over time, and this is just by an observation of someone who drove by, the little light began to go out at the beginning. And it took out the J-E-S. And it just said, us only. And I think the light was right about that church. The church wasn't really about Jesus. It wasn't about his ways and about people. It wasn't about anything. It was about them. We gather together, holy huddle, we do everything that we like to do, but the heck with everybody else. I think Jesus speaks about those churches in Revelation when he says, I stand at the door and knock. You know, in Revelation chapter 3, verse 20, people use that for evangelism, saying Jesus is standing at your heart's door and knocking. But in the context of Revelation, he's talking to the churches. Talking to the churches. It says Jesus standing on the outside of the church knocking, saying, can I come in? And most say, no, it's us only. It's all about us. We do what we like, what makes us comfortable. We don't care about any of those people. We really don't care about you, Jesus, coming in changing anything. Do we know what our perspective is? Do we know what our objective is? Are we in ministry for the glory of God and the joy of others? And those who still lack joy, do we care enough to express the joy? And do we care enough about each other to say, you know what, I need you and you need me. You have gifts. I need some kindred spirits. I need some those who will invest in me, and likewise, I need to invest in you. And that's where God grows the church. I want to remind you of the whole context of this in Philippians chapter 2, verse 5. This was the calling of the entire chapter. Chapter 2. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus. Christ lived for the glory of God. He was God. But he knew you were lacking the joy of the glory of God unless he stepped out and came and chose you to be with him and chose to use you and trust you enough to carry the message to others. What are we doing with that? As he invested in us, have we invested in others? Father, as we've gathered today, and I pray that the scripture here has not been found void, but it will hit the heart, it will hit the mind, and Father, ultimately hit the hands, that we will apply it. May we, whether we're as bold as Paul or as timid as Timothy or as obscure as Epaphroditus, Father, may you use our personalities and transform us to be kindred spirits with Christ. I want people to see us as those who represent Christ in a pure and godly way. May we never have a sign, even in our minds, that says us only. It's all about us. It's about me. Father, the church was designed for we. We work together. We shepherd together. We heal each other's hurts together by listening and caring for. We provide meals to each other. Father, let us also expand that if there are any in our world still lacking the joy of Christ, may we express that joy to our neighbors, to our co-workers. Father, may we minister together to meet the needs and to express the gospel of Christ, the only one that can save us.